This week on the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast.
I think it would be to utilize that delete key more often than you already do. At least that's the advice I have to give myself very frequently. I get a little attached to my favorite sentences and my favorite, you know, paragraphs and stories, and I just want to hang on to them. And sometimes what it takes for me to break through to the next good draft is to just throw a draft away and start over. Sometimes it's to kind of go through and pull out paragraphs and pieces that aren't working, delete them, and fill in with something else.
Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, sneakers, and welcome to the official centennial episode of this podcast. This episode is the big 100, the 100. I mean, I think it is. It's possible I lost count somewhere, but according to mine, it's kind of like when people ask how many books have you written, and I say I think it's 58, but it's possible. At any rate, my notes say this is the 100th episode, so by gosh, that's what we're calling it, right, Jesse?
Yep. No matter what,
I see Apple, the celebratory.
Yeah. No matter what Apple Podcast says, this is episode 100.
So. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, heck. As would be appropriate, this being the big centennial episode, I have a few announcements. First, we're calling this the end of season one. I know that's been like a 3-year season, but whatever. We're going to call this the end of season one. And we're going to take a summer break because I've got a lot of traveling and writing and whatnot to do. But never fear, and do not unsubscribe, please. We will return in late July or early August. Of course, at that point, it'll be the line drive toward WriterCon, the big annual conference, which of course is Labor Day weekend. That's September 2nd through 5th this year. And we may even be coming back with a title change, but it won't matter as long as you say subscribed to this. I saw Jesse react to that. What? Okay. You didn't read the script.
I read part of it.
As long as you are subscribed to this podcast, you'll continue to get it, whatever it's called. Jesse, do you have a favorite memory from our first 100?
Honestly, it was the time our guest didn't show up and I just interviewed you. I really enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun.
Well, low stress, low key.
Yeah. And the Christmas episode where we had like 6 guests on, that was just a lot of fun to hear from a lot of different people.
Yeah, that was just the exact opposite. We had all kinds of guests in that one, but we should do that again. Maybe get like all 60 people who are speaking at WriterCon to, maybe not, maybe pick 5 for maybe the headliners. Robert Degoni, I'm sure he would come on, and maybe Brad Parks and Steve James and some of the others. Anyway, since I'm already talking about it, basically, let me remind you that WriterCon is coming up, and this is the last podcast, obviously, before the price jumps. The early bird price expires on May 15th, so act now to get the sharply reduced early bird pricing. This annual conference is going to have more than 60 speakers this year, more than 70, actually, I think it's closer to 80 now, sessions spread over this holiday weekend. We've got sessions all day and workshops and private seminars. We got nighttime sessions this year and a great hotel. Basically, we're trying to provide whatever it is that would help you achieve your writing dreams. We got contests. We got agents and editors and talk about, you know, there are so many opportunities right now for authors. That's what we talk about in the news session every time. There's never been so much out there that authors can take advantage of if they know about it. So please come learn about it. And, you know, guess what? There'll probably be some talk about writing and how to improve your writing skills and how to grab an audience and thrive and write the books kind of people want to read and whatnot. So, you know, whatever it is you're hoping to achieve with your writing, WriterCon is there to help you achieve it. So please visit our website now before that price jump happens. It's WriterCon.com. WRITERCON.com. My special guest today is Mary Laura Philpott, whose new book, Bomb Shelter, is attracting all kinds of positive press and attention. It was called a masterwork by no less than the New York Times and a, quote, beautifully wrought ode to life by the Washington Post. Her previous book, which was also a national bestseller, I Miss You When I Blink, was one of NPR's favorite books of 2019 and a finalist for the Southern Book Prize. And she's also written all kinds of wonderful essays, ranging from the absurd to the profound, that have been in all kinds of major publications. Wonderful, wonderful nonfiction writer. I'm very anxious to chat with her, but first, the news. So I'm leading with this story because I know a lot of you writers, aspiring writers, seasoned writers, wherever you are, a lot like to write in coffee houses. I'm not one of them. I have a recliner at home that works perfect, and I can make my own coffee. But I know a lot of people go to coffee houses. So let me tell you about what might be the best one ever for writers, although you have to go to Tokyo to take advantage of it. It's the Manuscript Writing Cafe, which opened recently in Tokyo's Kenji neighborhood, created specifically for writers. In fact, to book time in this cafe, you've got to be doing some kind of writing. It can be novels, manuscripts, articles, even manga story boarding, whatever, so long as your pen is hitting the virtual paper, because I know most people are working on laptops, right? It's a metaphor. The requirement to get into the cafe is that you've got an intended writing goal for your time there, and they're going to do their best to make sure you meet it, because you see, first of all, you're going to be charged by the half hour. Every half hour you're there, you charged the equivalent of another $1.20. So you've got an incentive to not mess around and get your work done. And furthermore, you, by prior agreement, you abide by this. You are not allowed to leave until you achieve what you told them was your writing goal for that day. It's like mom looking over your shoulder. Have you written your 10 pages or whatever? Or it's like Hotel California, because you can check out anytime you like, but you're not getting out of there until you've achieved your writing goal. Jesse, is this something you would volunteer for?
Well, I like how it started out happy and then it got darker as you're trying to give it an analogy. I think it's a great idea because, like, I don't know about everybody else, but I work best on a deadline. I do not work well on open-ended projects. And something like writing a book is kind of, you have to give yourself your own deadlines if you want to get it done. So I'm told.
You're not the first man. I'm not one of them, but I've heard people say they can only write on deadlines. So here's one that you sort of volunteer. Or you could just get hungry because it's a coffee house. They don't have food. You're allowed to bring in food, but they're not going to serve you any. And, whining about writer's block is apparently not going to do anything for you here. Okay, second story. Amazon, always appearing in the news section, it seems like. Amazon has launched what is, in effect, a competitor to Shopify. They're calling it Buy with Prime. And the idea is that Amazon is going to allow any kind of merchants, including writers selling books or other goods, to sell from their own website, but to still take advantage of Amazon Prime delivery and all the other Amazon services that go with being part of Prime. As you probably know, because we've talked about it here, there is a growing trend, particularly in the last year or so, toward writers selling books either exclusively or in addition on their website. But, you know, if you do that and you're not Brandon Sanderson, then that creates all kinds of problems with packaging and shipping and having them. Well, now Amazon will do all of that, including the same day or next day service or whatnot, but you can still sell it direct to the consumer from your website. Right now, the invitations are limited to those who use Fulfillment by Amazon, but the idea is that eventually the program is going to be open to everybody. You know, we were just talking about how this, you know, people selling from their website is a growing trend and to a lot of authors making a serious amount of money. And this could take away a lot of the headaches for people. Jesse, what do you think? Game changer for authors?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of surprising. Amazon usually wants to keep you on Amazon.
Right.
And I'm suspicious. I'm like, this seems too good of a deal for people. And so I don't know where Amazon's going to try to screw those people over in doing so. But they do have the infrastructure to ship things very quickly. And if you can take advantage of that, that would be very useful.
Well, I suppose you're still shopping at Amazon and they've, you know, sort of, and they're still in the loop. And of course, as anybody who owns Amazon stock probably knows, they just posted the worst quarter in about 10 years and the stock dropped. So maybe this is, like you say, a way of taking advantage of what they've got and expanding it so that they're making more money.
Interesting. I'm sad. Yeah, I'm sad Sells is going to go out of business, but that's a good tech name. Well done, everybody. So,
all right, then. Enough with the news. Let's get on to our guest. My guest today is Mary Laura Philpott, who, as I mentioned, is the author of many things, including a new book called Bomb Shelter, Love, Time, and Other Explosions. Mary Laura, are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thank you for being on the podcast. Hey, traditional first question. If you could offer one piece of advice to writers, what would that be?
I think it would be to utilize that delete key more often than you already do. At least that's the advice I have to give myself very frequently. I get a little attached to my favorite sentences and my favorite, paragraphs and stories, and I just want to hang on to them. And sometimes what it takes for me to break through to the next good draft is to just throw a draft away and start over. Sometimes it's to kind of go through and pull out paragraphs and pieces that aren't working, delete them and fill in with something else. But one of the things that helps me do that without fear, because I'm always afraid, like, what if I delete it? And then I realize tomorrow that was the best part and I'll never get it back. Yeah. I keep a little running, I think of it like a Lego bucket where you toss the blocks you don't need. I have a little document called Legos where I just throw the pieces that I've pulled out and deleted. And I know they're there. I can go back to them. So delete liberally.
Has there ever actually been a time when you thought, oh, that thing I deleted yesterday, that was perfect?
All the time.
Really?
In fact, yes. In fact, that Legos document often, when it gets full enough of little pieces of things, I'll go scroll through it. And sometimes I'll find a little chunk of something that at the time I was like, oh, this is garbage. I don't need it. And in a different state of mind and at a different time, I can find that little piece and remember, wait, I remember why I wrote that little bit. That's going to take me down a different road. And then that becomes something else. So I never throw things all the way away, but I do often have to remind myself to delete a little more vigorously from within the document I'm working on.
Well, that's the magic of word processors, right?
Indeed.
Unless you're really foolish, you can always find the last draft. You're not talking about completely throwing things, starting from scratch on the fifth draft. You're talking about, I've noticed that journey from first draft to final draft, I've usually lost about 20,000 words from the first draft as a rule of thumb on a novel. Is that what you're really talking about? Seeing the manuscript shrink?
Seeing it shrink, also just seeing it, being willing to see it change direction. Every now and then when I'm working on a chapter or an essay, I will think I know where it's going to land. Like, I'm going to tell you a story about this thing that happened as a way of making that point. And I'll start telling the story and it's not heading toward that point. And I realize, I actually think something different than I thought about this. This is going to land somewhere else. But sometimes I have a struggle because I get so attached to where I want to land and I don't want to delete what I've been working on. And, you can tell when you read something where the author has just lost the thread midway through. So giving myself permission to say, actually, let's take this draft and set it aside. Now let's cut off the whole last half and take that first half and create a different draft out of it. And I'm not talking for a whole book, although I'm sure that's doable. I mean, like within a chapter or within an essay. Giving myself that freedom has often resulted in much better pieces.
Fantastic. Well, let's talk about Bomb Shelter. I read this morning that you said that the idea for this book or the initial inspiration came from a truly terrifying event. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Actually, there are a few truly terrifying events in this book, but I think you're talking about the one at the beginning. I'll pick one. Life is terrifying. So this is a kind of slice of life memoir about 2 years of my life. And I was headed toward writing this book anyway. I'm an essayist. I tend to write short pieces about just everyday life. And I was beginning to write through the idea of this age. I think of myself as middle-aged. I've got parents who are living but getting older, and I've got kids who are no longer kids and are turning into adults. And I was in this stage of life where a lot of the things that had been stable for a while were beginning to destabilize. So I was writing through that whole idea, and probably would have come out with a book similar to this. Wait, it's on that side. Similar to this at some point. And then something happened that kicked it all into a different gear. I think that's what you're talking about. My husband and I woke up at 4 a.m. one morning to a sound that in my sleep, I couldn't figure out. I thought it was somebody banging on our front door. And it turned out to be the sound of my teenage son's body hitting the bathroom floor. He had gotten up to get a glass of water, and you know, it's a tile floor. So he had walked in, dropped cold, hit the ground. And what I was hearing was him having a seizure. So his body was hitting the floor again and again and again. And I tell that story at the beginning of Bomb Shelter, the 911 call, the day that we spent in the hospital, finding out by the end of that same day that he had epilepsy, which was an absolute total surprise. No one saw that coming. And that day, talk about, you know, things that were stable becoming destabilized. It turned my whole world upside down. So suddenly I was in an even more urgent state of that what's going on, the ground is shifting beneath my feet mindset. And that story and my attempt to A, get him safe, you know, safe by the time he graduated from high school, and then B, accept the fact that you can never really get somebody safe. You can't protect the people you love forever. That provided the narrative drive for the rest of the book.
Right, right. Mm. Let me invite listeners while I'm thinking about it. If you have any questions you'd like to ask Mary Laura about this book or anything else, just post them in the chat and we'll see that she answers it. Okay. What I'm interested in, so that was horrifying.
Indeed.
I remember once when my son had a seizure, though he was much, much younger and not a teenager. And I can still remember that very vividly, but I haven't written about it. You have. How did you turn that into this book?
Well, I had to think carefully about whether and how to include that scene in this book, because the book is not about, it's not about my son. It's not about his illness journey. It's not even really just about me being his mother and going through this thing. It's about me being in this phase of life where everything is changing. And I thought about not including that scene and that story thread in the book, because I never have really written in great personal detail about my family before. It's always been my rule of thumb to protect their privacy. I'm only interested in telling my own story, not the story of other people. But I realized I couldn't tell the Bomb Shelter story. I couldn't tell the story of once upon a time, there is a woman whose whole world turns upside down. How does she fight her way back up to the surface? If I couldn't make you see and feel and hear just what that low point looked and felt and sounded like. So I had to include that scene from the perspective of the me character. Now, what I don't have to do is flesh out my son as a whole character in this book. I don't need to name him. You don't need to really know much about him other than this role he plays in my life. So that's how I drew the boundaries really carefully. I also made sure, of course, that he had read it, you know. My entire family read the draft before it went to anybody else, and they were very gracious and supportive of it.
That's great.
But yeah, I was very concerned about boundaries as I was writing.
Right, right. Well, and telling stories that aren't yours to tell, right?
Right.
Love, Time, and Other Explosions is the subtitle. So, okay, now you've kind of told us what the book isn't about. What would you say that the book is about? Describe it for the audience.
Yeah, it's a memoir. I typically write essays. That's what I've always written. My last book was considered an essay collection. This one is technically considered a memoir, although you might call it a memoir in essays. I don't care as much about the category, but it's just a 2-year slice of life story about being a human being who has always enjoyed control and has always sort of had this idea that if I just take good enough care of everybody in my life, if I love everybody hard enough and I love them right and I do all the right things, I will keep everybody safe and everything will be okay. And when this thing happens with my son, it just, you know, breaks that assumption wide open. This didn't happen to him because I didn't take good care of him. It didn't happen to him because I didn't love him right. It happened because sometimes horrible stuff happens. So how do I find my way back to being able to get up in the morning with a sense of purpose and even joy and keep going once I've reconciled with the fact that actually I can't keep everybody safe?
Mm-hmm. So here's the problem as I see it. There are a lot of people who I see at workshops or at the conference who want to write memoir, who have had significant or, you know, things that are important to them happen. But mm-hmm. the block you run up against is, okay, yeah, it's fascinating to you. It happened to you. How do you make it interesting to other people so that they'll want to read? I mean, that's the trick in something like this, isn't it?
That's the big question. And you have to think of it. I talk through this with writers all the time. And it's not to say that you shouldn't write something just because it's important to you. I think there's great value in writing, even not to publish, write through the things that have happened to you and find the meaning in them. But if you are going to go to the extra step of attempting to publish it and put it out there as a book, it has to have that universal thread. You have to be able to substitute in place of the me character. You know, think of it like, okay, what if this were a novel and this was, you know, give the person a different name instead of Mary Laura. It's, you know, whoever, Susie. You're reading a book about Susie. What happens to her? It's got to have all the elements that any good piece of entertainment would have. So it's got to have, you know, the strong opening. It's got to have pacing and foreshadowing and dialogue and whatever anybody would put into a book that's going to hold your attention and a story that's going to hold your attention. All that has to be there as well. So it's an interesting juggling act because, you know, on the one hand, you're doing this sort of very personal, almost therapeutic act of writing through the thing that has happened to you. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, in a really detached way, you have to think like a showrunner on TV or like a director in a play. And you have to be looking at yourself as a character and you have to be looking at what happened as pieces of plot, and you have to construct this emotional narrative arc in a way that is compelling and that keeps people turning pages.
Yeah. And that is the trick, but it would appear you do it very, very well. So you've written all the essays in your previous book. I know many have appeared in newspapers and magazines. Do you have a favorite?
Oh gosh, a favorite essay?
Yeah.
I have some favorites for different reasons. That chapter in Bomb Shelter where I describe finding my son, although it is a dark moment, is among my favorites because I've probably worked on that harder than I've ever worked on anything in my life. And it was published separately. The Washington Post published that as an excerpt. And I asked the editor there if she would be willing to publish it without any adaptation. So not shortening it, not adding context from other chapters, just drop it in whole. And she did, which I loved. So I love that one because I feel like I felt so hard that I needed to do right by that incident and by my son, who doesn't remember that happening. He has no memory of it. I really wanted to get it right. So that one has a special place in my heart. There's another one in Bomb Shelter that I kind of love. It's the part in the book where the me character is trying as hard as she can to just grasp onto any stability she can find. And so I discover meditation and I'm like, meditation. Everyone says that works. That's what will get me through. That will get me calm and feeling good again. And so the essay is basically a dialogue between the guided meditation in my ear, what the narrator is saying, you know, you are a rock in a stream and the water is flowing around you. And then what my brain is saying back in reply. And it's an absurd, crazy little essay, but I love it because it is so true, I think, to the human brain and the way it actually works when we try to impose order on it that it's maybe not ready for.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's something I read over and over again, critics and reviewers and whatnot talking about your book, and very complimentary, noting that your writing could have them laughing and crying on the same page, basically. I mean, that's pretty impressive tonal balance shift. I'm not even sure what to call it, but are you aware of that? How do you achieve that?
I am aware of it, and it is something I'm going for on purpose, although it is also a little bit a reflection of just the way my brain works. I tend to be somebody who at the same time can be noticing like, look at that adorable puppy, and we're all going to die from climate change. You know, those thoughts exist in my head right next to each other all the time. So it's not like it's a big stretch for me to take, you know, something really profound and sad and something really funny and delightful and have them be next to each other, because that is, to me, how life is. Mm-hmm. But in terms of doing that through writing, I like encountering that in the entertainment that I consume. I like that in books. I like it in movies. I like it in TV shows. If I have watched a movie that has made me cry and also laugh out loud, I feel like I've gotten my money's worth. I love that full emotional circuit board right. experience. So yeah, I'm aiming for that. And I like to try to sort of modulate the emotions as I go, because I'm hoping to give that experience to my readers.
Yeah, good answer. Well said. So does research, I mean, nonfiction sometimes involves research. I realize you're often writing about yourself and your own experiences, but there's probably some times when you have to supplement that, I'm guessing. How do you go about that?
I mean, the same way anybody would go about any research. There, and you're right, there's not as much of it in certain memoirs. In mine, probably there's less than others, but there were things I had to research. I wanted to make sure I got all the scientific details about epilepsy. Not that there's a lot of scientific detail in this book, but when there was, I wanted to get it right. I didn't want to be the person who used the wrong term for something and made, you know, something that's already confusing to people even more confusing. There's a chapter in Bomb Shelter where, and this is the point where the me character is struggling with the idea. Everybody's telling me, you know, okay, so your son had a seizure. It might not ever happen again. You don't need to worry. And my brain is going, you can't tell me that just because something happened once means it won't ever happen again. It very well could happen again. And as a way of illustrating that, I reflect on something that happened when I was little, which was that in 1982, the height of the stranger danger craze in the 1980s, where everyone was telling us we were going to be kidnapped all the time, a girl in my neighborhood was actually kidnapped. She was stolen from her home by a stranger. And all of us little kids in the neighborhood were aware of it. And looking back, people say, oh, you know, stranger danger was overblown. There wasn't really a rash of kidnappings. But there was where I lived, because one kidnapping right. is a rash of kidnappings right. in your neighborhood. So to put myself back in that time, which is hard because I was little, I was seven. I went back and watched a bunch of 80s TV. I watched news coverage of the Adam Walsh disappearance. I watched the made-for-TV movie about the Adam Walsh disappearance that came out after the case was over.
I remember.
So that was multiple days of like sitting on my back porch, which is where I did a lot of work during the pandemic, sitting on my back porch, just immersed in this 1980s television culture and this 1980s paranoia of kidnapping, which, and that was all just to serve one chapter, but I really wanted to get it right and to have it reflect what that time felt like.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your writing process. You know, do you write every day? Do you get up in the early in the morning? What works for you?
I am not a get up in the early in the morning person. Not that I sleep late, but like,
Jesse's
I like
all on board with that.
Yeah, no, I get up in time to get whoever needs to go to school off to school. And then I work. And I know people who get up at 3 or 4 in the morning and they knock their writing out. It's not me. So I usually work from once everybody's out of the house, 8-ish, until my brain runs out, which is usually maybe 1 in the afternoon, 2 if I'm lucky. And then I do whatever else needs doing, emails, whatever. During the time in which I wrote a lot of Bomb Shelter, which was the pandemic. So I started Bomb Shelter in 2019. I finished it halfway through 2021. So it was about a 2-year process.
Right.
About a year and a half of that was pandemic. So in that process, I had longer work days than I had ever had before. I wasn't going anywhere. I really had nothing to do but this project. So I had always sort of thought of myself as a multitasker before and thought that I did great work when I was bouncing in and out of the writing work and off to other things and then coming back to it. And I think I actually did better work when I stayed immersed in it. So I learned something about myself through that process.
Hmm. So pantser, planner, I mean, do you outline where this book is going or what essays it will be composed of? I mean, it's a little tricky with the kind of book you're writing. So how do you go about the planning?
Yeah, it's sort of a hybrid. I think outlining is fascinating. And I've read a lot about how novelists do it. Like on purpose, I read books about how do novelists outline novels, because I'm interested in how do you plan a story such that you're putting, you know, the different beats at different intervals and you're getting different emotional hits at different spots. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to apply that sort of planning to a memoir, which I think you can do. You can take the events of real life and give them a structure that satisfies that story hunger that people have. Mm-hmm. So I did kind of iteratively, outline is too strong a word, but iteratively sort of sketch out an arc and sketch out, I think I'm going to put this here. I think I'm going to put this here. And then as I went, as I was writing the specific chapters and the scenes and everything, I would adjust that. So I've never been somebody who can just make one really grand outline and then follow it. I don't know if anybody is. Maybe there are people out there who are. But it's also not a matter of just like sitting down and seeing what comes out every day.
Right, right. We got a couple questions coming in from listeners. Here's one. Sharon would like to know, do you have a favorite author? And if so, who and why?
Oh, my word, Sharon. Do you want me to get murdered by naming just one author on here? That's a lovely question. And I would have to make a huge list. I guess I would point to behind me, there's a stack. And I know you can't see this from where you are, but I have a stack of memoirs that have been inspiring to me. And it ranges from Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking, and Blue Nights are two fantastic memoirs about encapsulated periods of time mm-hmm. and grief. And in that way, we're similar to Bomb Shelter and inspiring to me. I've got David Sedaris's essays back here. I've got, oh my goodness, so many things. David Rakoff, The Bright Hour by Nina Riggs, Danny Shapiro. Oh my word, a lot. Mm. I have a ton of favorite authors.
Well, I saw the stack, but I thought they were just there to prop up Bomb Shelter. So that
they're doing that too. They're doing that and they're also blocking your view of my front door.
Well, that's, you know, normally, as I said before we began, I usually have a copy of your book over my head, but I failed this time. Fortunately, you have two.
I have two.
You.
We're covered.
So that compensates. Here's another question. This one's from Jenny. She would like to know, do you find writing about your life's joys, sadness, and anxieties to be cathartic?
You know, I do think there is a cathartic or therapeutic value to writing. Absolutely. I think that is separate from the creative job of making a book. And sometimes the reason I point that out is sometimes I'll have people say, it must feel so great to write a book. You get it all out. It's therapeutic, it's cathartic. And then when you're done, you have a book. Those are two very different things. Yeah. I could journal out what something felt like and get it on paper. And that feels so much better to get it out of my head and put words to it. And what that would amount to would probably be a first very, very messy draft out of maybe 8 drafts. So yes, it's cathartic, but the catharsis is not enough of a reason to go to the trouble of writing a book, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Can we talk about themes for a minute? Because I don't want anybody to get the impression that this is, or the previous book for that matter, like a random collection of essays, because I think there's a lot of connective tissue. Are you aware of that when you're writing it? Is there an overriding theme or idea?
Yeah, you know, it was different for each book. So I think of I Miss You When I Blink as an essay collection. Like I had a pile of essays. I looked at them and said, what do these have in common? And I realized there were a couple of really strong thematic threads. And then I filled out the rest of that collection intentionally sticking to those themes. Then I moved them around. I actually spread them out on my living room floor, moved them all around, got them into an order that I felt like created a larger narrative arc. And then I went through and edited with that arc and with those themes in mind. So that's how that process went. And in the end, I think what I had was a thematically linked essay collection. That's what I would call I Miss You When I Blink. Bomb Shelter, although I think you could probably call the chapters essays, and there are several that you could read on their own and they would stand alone and you would say, yeah, that makes sense. I think of it as a memoir. I think of it as one story that has a beginning and an end and a middle and all the places in between. So as I was writing that one, there was no question about maybe I should throw in an essay on this, or like, here's an essay I wrote. Could it fit in here? I was very much telling a story. And so every time I veered off or digressed into what might look at first like a digression, like, why is she telling us about this old sweater she has? It was for the purpose of bringing you back to that main story about that me character. So that they were kind of two different experiences.
Right. Can we talk about marketing just a minute? Growing, I don't know, item of importance or a thing authors can't avoid even if they'd like to, but I saw on your website, you've spent the better part of April doing really one of the most significant tours I've seen in several years. How did that go?
I'm tired. Oh, it was, you know, we had a great Zoom call with the publishing team behind this book. We call them the Bomb Squad. And we all got on a Zoom before this tour started. And they said, you know, listen, we want you to understand we don't have specific expectations for how this is going to go. You're really the first one we've sent out on an, you know, 2019 style tour since the pandemic. You're the canary in the coal mine. Go out there, see what happens, come back and report to the group. So I did go into it with a, you know, a sense of experimentation, knowing the world is not the same as it was. And indeed, many things are different. Air travel is different. Hotels are, you know, just on like a logistical level, room service has all but gone away, which may sound like a very silly thing, but when you're doing an evening book event that finishes around 9, and then you take an Uber by yourself back to your hotel, and it's like 10 and it's dark and you don't know where you are.
I get it. Yeah.
You're not going to walk out and go find dinner. So I had to learn to, you know, forage a little bit. But the best parts of book tour are intact, being able to sit in a room and actually read out loud to an audience of readers and have people ask questions and ask you to sign their books. And then they tell you stories from their lives. You know, although everywhere I went was sort of in a different stage of reopening, some places it was like, there's been no pandemic. We've got 100 people in here and it's just like it always was. And other places were, you know, a little more cautious. They had people spread out or they had capped the crowd at a certain number. The essence of book tour was still there, which was sweet.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I was out of town last week in a hotel in California, and very similar, late night, hungry. But I found a pizza place that would deliver, except I had to go downstairs to the lobby to pick it up. But still, better.
Fair
than,
enough. Yeah.
Yeah, it worked.
Better than a kind bar. Yeah.
One last question, Mary Laura. What next? Okay, Bomb Shelter is out. You've got a hit. What's happening next? What are you going to write next?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. And I remember I would be panicked about not knowing, except that I remember this from last time. I remember in the late spring of 2019, coming back from the first part of the I Miss You When I Blink tour and sitting at home going, oh, well, I guess I've had my last good idea. It was a good run. It's over. I've got nothing. Meanwhile, all the events that are in Bomb Shelter had happened. Yeah. They were all right there, but I wasn't seeing them yet for what they could be story-wise. And I think I enjoy, maybe more than some people do, the marketing and publicity process. Like, to me, I'm still in the life cycle of Bomb Shelter.
This book, right?
You know, because I'm still traveling, I'm still talking about it. I'm still in the life cycle of this book, and my brain hasn't gotten ready to switch gears. That makes me nervous. I hope I haven't had my last good idea, but I'm going to have faith that maybe it will be like last time and something will bubble up at some point.
I bet it does. Hey, I lied before when I said one last question, because I just saw one that popped into the chat box. This is from Betsy. She wants to know, did you always want to be a writer? When did you know that was your life's path?
Those are two great related questions with related answers. I think if I were to look back at myself as a child and a teenager and a college student and even a young adult, I could have pointed to a million different times when it was very clear that I was a writer. I was writing, but I did not know. I just was so ignorant of the various ways you could have a path and a career as a writer. It never occurred to me all those years when I would like sit in the bathtub reading the back of the shampoo bottles and sort of editing them in my head to be snappier, that's somebody's job. Somebody writes the copy on the back of a shampoo bottle. Somebody writes ads. Somebody writes speeches. Like anything you hear or consume that's in words, somebody has written that. So it took me a while professionally to find my way to writing as a job. And when I finally did, I was doing corporate communications and speech writing and ghost writing and ways where you can get a paycheck relatively quickly for turning around a piece of writing. And that's how I honed my skills for a while in the beginning. And then found my way to writing in my own voice. I wouldn't say late in life, certainly not late. I was in my 30s, but later than a lot of people who are like in college going, I'm going to write, you know, in my own voice forever. It didn't occur to me that early that that could be something that I could do.
Yeah. I'm glad it did, because we're all a lot richer as a result. Hey, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
All right. Like I said, annual writers, you won't get to hear me say this for at least a couple of months during the summer. So let me say one more time on this centennial episode, WriterCon, early bird price is good till May 15th. We've got authors, agents, editors, book marketers, author assistants, all kinds of sessions, chances for you to meet people, network, get the connections and knowledge you need to build your writing career. Find out more about it at writercon.com. Let me also remind you, since I won't be talking to you for a little while on this podcast, you can still, you know, go to the Facebook group, Red Sneaker Writers, so you can get daily updates all through the summer. And I have the free Red Sneaker Writers e-newsletter that goes out every other week. All you have to do is send me your email address and I'll add you to it. My email address is willburn@gmail.com. First four letters are both names, willburn@gmail.com. But the point was that I was going to remind you about my most recent book, Shameless, book 3 in the Splitsville Legal Thriller series. Check it out. See if that might be your summer book. And I think that's it. Stay tuned. We will return in a couple months with more news, more writing advice, and more authors you can learn from. Until next time, keep writing. And remember, sneakers, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit. See you later. Bye-bye.